Welcome into the best in true crime podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. We have a very interesting show today, and I want to, first of all, I almost never dedicate shows, but today I'm going to dedicate a show. This is Black History Month, and some people know, some people don't. My stepfather is African American. He passed away a little over a decade ago. One of the favorite things that Pop and I would do is we'd share music. And we shared a lot of different genres of music, everything from Al Green to early blues to even R&B and rap music. And we loved a lot of Notorious B.I.G. and Pop really loved Tupac Shakur. And that was for a lot of reasons, but one of those reasons being that if you've ever seen the movie American Gangster with Denzel Washington, when he was very young, he actually was on the other side of the law, even though Uncle Wayne, who raised him, was a New York City police officer. He worked for Frank Lucas. And that's one of the things that was on the not so great side of Pop's resume, I guess you could say. He did a little dirt in his day. But some of Tupac's music put him kind of in that frame of mind. It reminded him of some of the, I guess you could say, the good old bad days, put it that way. But he would get a certain smile on his face. It would remind him of some of the people he lost. It would remind him of some of the times that he could relate to. And it would put him back in that place that sometimes there were some good times. And he would just reminisce. You could see that look on his face, and he really related to Tupac. I have a guest with me today that I got a hold of his materials and I wanted to kind of bring him in right away, and I want to talk with him right away. So I'm going to skip the formalities and get straight to John Potash, who has an exhibit in L.A. that we want to talk about. And I'm going to have him explain this exhibit in L.A. having to do with Tupac Shakur. Let's bring him in right away. John Potash, welcome to True Crime Tuesday. John, explain what's going on, first of all, with this exhibit with Tupac Shakur.
Yeah, so the exhibit is from the Afeni Shakur estate and family. And it's not from me. I have a new book release, The FBI War on Tupac Shakur, State Repression of Black Leaders from the Civil Rights Era to the 1990s. But it just happens my book, has been released in the last two or three months, about the same time as this new exhibit. It just started in Los Angeles in January. And the exhibit will run for 6 months in Los Angeles. And then it's actually a whole museum that can travel. It's a whole museum of Tupac Shakur's life and family. His mother, Afeni Shakur, was one time member of the Harlem, one time leader, actually, of the Harlem Black Panthers. Mm-hmm. And so that exhibit will be shown for 6 months in Los Angeles and then touring into different cities around the country. And so my book is a new version of a original release from 2007. And the new version just has, is a bigger publisher with bigger, greater kind of, reach, worldwide. And so I'm just happy to, get this out in a new format. And, I'm happy to get this information out. And some of this information that you just talked about, relates to who Tupac really was. So some of his music did relate to gang activity. The issue is, what he was trying to do is he had a political plan with his imprisoned stepfather, Matulu Shakur, who was an acupuncture therapist who had started an incredible new kind of treatment for addictions using acupuncture at Lincoln Detox in the Bronx. Now, they came up with a new plan to politicize gangs and to pretend like Tupac was a gangster, to politicize gangs, to appeal to gangs and politicize them and turn them more into activism.
Okay, we'll unveil a lot of that here in just a second here, John. I want to kind of get to that in due time. Sure. I do want to kind of slowly kind of unroll that a little bit here as we move along. John, I want to get a little bit about your background first, and then we'll move into that here. Sure. I do want to kind of get your background first, and then I want to get into the beginnings of this book here. And first of all, let's get a bit about yourself and your background, and then how you got interested in the story of Tupac.
Yeah, so my family was very political. My father organized Doctors Against the Vietnam War. My grandfather was a Marxist lawyer who was a very successful defense attorney in Maryland. But he also was a radical. He did free work for the NAACP his whole career. And he also defended Black Panthers in New York. I didn't hear a whole lot about that, but I heard about, you know, there was a few different Black Panther chapters in New York, and he just defended and got some off, you know, in criminal charges in New York before he retired. And so I grew up in that kind of environment of hearing about that and being open-minded, of course, to Black Panthers and radical history that way. And so when I was working in Baltimore City as a addictions counselor starting in 1989, I started hearing stories from some of my Black Panther counseling clients counseling clients who said, one who said, my father was a Black Panther killed by the police. And so I started investigating the Black Panthers a lot more at that time in 1989, 1990. And started reading about the Shakurs, who were the leading Black Panthers in the New York area. And so when Tupac in 1994 got shot in what the Washington Post called another strange twist in police corruption around Tupac's situation, I called Tupac's New York trial lawyer, Michael Treif Warren, and said, do you think the FBI is targeting Tupac like they targeted his Black Panther parents in New York? And he said, yes, and no one's writing about it. So he gave me a 2-hour interview at that time, and for an article I published in before Tupac died in the spring of 1995. And that article, no one would publish it nationally, but a local, you know, magazine published it. And it just talked about a possible new FBI counterintelligence program targeting Tupac. And but then he, you know, was murdered, assassinated, you could say. But he was murdered in 1996, September of 1996. And then a much larger national publication started by a CIA whistleblower named Phil Agee called Covert Action Quarterly published a much expanded article based on that theme that there was an FBI counterintelligence program targeting Tupac.
Okay.
For his political activism.
Now, the entire book just doesn't focus on Tupac, obviously. You go back. The name of the book, by the way, is The FBI War on Tupac Shakur, State Repression on Black Leaders from the Civil Rights Era to the 1990s. So you do go back into history and look at the oppression of civil rights leaders based on that. Interestingly enough, my stepdad did know and work with Malcolm X, which is one of the leaders that you focus on.
Yeah, sure.
In the book.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so what I found was is that the Shakurs, studying the Shakurs, I believe, offers a window into the these great Black leaders like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and the Black Panthers, because Tupac's kind of grandfather, Saeedine Abba Shakur, was a close comrade of he was part of Marcus Garvey's group. And then he was a close comrade of Malcolm X's before Malcolm X died. And then he had his sons, his biological sons, Lumumba Shakur and Zaid Shakur, end up joining Malcolm X's group right before Malcolm X died. And so that was looking at the targeting tactics against the Shakurs, I found some similar tactics and personnel that targeted Malcolm X, targeted the Shakurs. Eugene Roberts was a FBI police infiltrator of Malcolm X's group and rose to be head of security. And then Eugene Roberts infiltrated the Black Panthers when Lumumba Shakur started the Harlem Black Panthers, and his wife, Afeni Shakur, ended up being a co-leader of the Harlem Black Panthers at one point. And that was Afeni Shakur, Tupac's mother. And so Eugene Roberts helped set up the New York Black Panthers and came out in trial saying he worked for the Bureau of Special Services of the New York Police Intelligence Unit. and you know, that worked with the FBI and the FBI's counterintelligence program. So that all came out in court, and he was just one of about six that came out in court saying that. So those are some of the ways that the overlap between the targeting of the Shakurs and the targeting of course, Malcolm X. And I believe, you know, show the evidence that the U.S. intelligence set up the assassination of Malcolm X along with Martin Luther King using similar tactics between those two great leaders.
Well, John, here's where I'm a little confused, I guess. At the end of Malcolm X's life, he had renounced the Nation of Islam and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and he had kind of gone his own way. He had done the pilgrimage right to Mecca, and he had taken a more peaceful route. At this point, why does the FBI decide they need to continue going after Malcolm X at this point? And why do they decide that he's still a threat of any means when he's taken a more peaceful journey, for lack of a better term?
Well, he still believed in self-defense through any means necessary, he said, through all means necessary. And he was more of a threat when he coalesced with white civil rights leaders and white activists, you know, and whites, you know, that were the white Muslims around the world, and was, you know, kind of joining forces with Martin Luther King's movement too, with just slightly different, you know, philosophy on tactics in terms of self, you know, believing in armed self-defense. Mm-hmm. And so he was more of a threat. He got more political when he left Elijah Muhammad's group. Elijah Muhammad was a separatist group. It believed in just completely separating, you know, more from the white community and not being as Elijah Muhammad stifled what Malcolm X's political activism a bit. And that's one of the reasons that Malcolm X left the Nation of Islam and Elijah Muhammad from my readings. And so he was actually more of a threat when he became, you know, more widely politically accepting of a lot of different groups that he would work with in doing, you know, his great work. And he was very against the Vietnam War. He was one of the first black leaders. You know, he was really the first American internationally known black leader to speak out against the Vietnam War. And, you know, along with being for black liberation and black civil rights, you know, and civil rights in general and all that. So he was more of a threat when he left Elijah Muhammad's group. Yeah.
When we look at different television materials and we see things on the assassination of Malcolm X, we tend to see that it was the inner workings of the Nation of Islam that went after Malcolm X. Are you saying that it was definitely governmental forces, or was it governmental forces working with the Nation of Islam that went after Malcolm X?
Well, I show the evidence, and I lean on the evidence that it's governmental forces. I do believe that a lot of governmental forces also, I mean, I have the evidence that the governmental infiltrators infiltrated the Nation of Islam. So there were governmental, you know, undercover agents in the Nation of Islam that took part in the targeting of Malcolm X also. Now, did Elijah Muhammad work with those governmental forces? I don't know. And that's not something I can speculate about. I just do know, though, that, you know, there was governmental forces involved. And one of them, may have been a member of the Nation of Islam, but also could have been, you know, an undercover agent in the Nation of Islam. So I'm just not sure. I do point out the particular people that did infiltrate the Nation of Islam that also targeted Malcolm X earlier. So that's the key thing is that I'm just pointing out the governmental forces involved because they're the most powerful forces, obviously. And I think they did this again because of Malcolm X's great anti-war stance against the Vietnam War and for his great civil rights organizing, which was really human rights organizing because he was meeting with, you know, African national leaders who was the only American they would accept into their meetings there, you know, when they gained liberation for their whole countries from colonial powers. And so, I think Malcolm X was an incredible force for good for the 99% of us around the world.
Now, Malcolm X, I guess I can understand being the more militant out of the two civil rights leaders. What I can't wrap my head around is Martin Luther King Jr. A man who, I guess, is the more peaceful out of the two and who's bringing the two races together between black and white. Explain to me what the what the rationale is between trying to get rid of a man who's trying to bring people together.
Yeah, so here's the issue about you got to look at U.S. intelligence and who controls U.S. intelligence. I believe our country, sadly enough, the control of our country was usurped by the wealthiest oligarchs, the, you know, or the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the Harrimans, the J.P. Morgans, and those wealthiest families. Now, they had started, I just mentioned this, I go into this more in my other book, Drugs as Weapons Against Us, the CIA War on Musicians and Activists, and a new film coming out with, you know, this spring or summer. Mm-hmm. But I get more into it about the eugenics movement. Now, these wealthiest families started the eugenics movement, which was anti anyone who wasn't wealthy white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And it called most people, particularly blacks. It said 90% of blacks are inferior and should be sterilized or done away with. It said 60% of Irish were inferior, should be sterilized or done away with. 60% of Jews, et cetera, Catholics from parts of Italy should be sterilized and done away with. This is in their literature, and it goes up to World War II when the Nazis gave it a bad name. They went more underground, but they were still active, and they started the CIA. These wealthiest families started the CIA in 1947 with the National Security Act of 1947. According to highest level whistleblowers, the CIA, Victor Marchetti, in his book, The Cult of Intelligence, and Frances Stoner Saunders, a British magazine editor, in her book, The Cultural Cold War, they put their own family members at the top of the CIA, and the CIA was made the director of all 14-plus intelligence agencies, including the FBI. And it was the FBI's counterintelligence program, which was the lead that I talk about in my book, but I also talk about the CIA overlap with the FBI in targeting these leaders. And so they were incredibly racist, and they were incredibly pro-war. And they were genocidal, these people, these families. And that's why America's got perpetual war. It's constant war, partly to make money for these defense contractors, partly to take over the resources of other countries, and partly to, I believe, to exterminate people of color or anyone who wants to get in their way of taking over the resources. And so that's why I think they were so against Martin Luther King, because he not only did he, you know, preach for black liberation and black equal rights, but he also preached against the Vietnam War. He was the second great national leader to come out officially against the Vietnam War in his speech in 1967 at Harlem church. And when he did that, exactly 1 year to the day, he was assassinated, Martin Luther King, and his good friend. And William Pepper, who wrote some great books investigating this, said it was no coincidence that he was killed 1 year to the day. It was some kind of anniversary timing tactic, basically, is what I call it, because I show a lot of evidence that used that tactic against the Shakurs. But with MLK, he's assassinated exactly 1 year later after coming out officially against the Vietnam War, despite people telling him not to do that. And all the evidence points to government forces being heavily involved in that, and also using some mafia to help them in that effort to assassinate Martin Luther King, sadly enough.
So as we go down the line, and as we're starting with the least resistant and going down the line to the most resistant, we eventually get to the Black Panther Party. And the mm-hmm. Black Panther Party is one of the more militant groups out there that takes Malcolm X's philosophy and takes it even a step further. Explain to our audience that isn't familiar with the Black Panther Party what their credo is, and how Afeni Shakur and eventually Tupac's dad fit into the Black Panther Party and how they met.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, the Shakurs, Saidi Naba Shakur and Lumumba, his biological sons, Lumumba and Zaid Shakur, had been part of Malcolm X's group before he died. And so they were very recognized by the activist black community as potential great leaders. And so when Huey Newton and Bobby Seale started the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense in 1966, in October of 1966 in Oakland, California, they wanted to, you know, they wanted to continue some great activism of like Malcolm X, but they were also involved in other activist groups. But they just thought that these activist groups weren't doing enough to work against police brutality. So they decided that, okay, we're going to work on civil rights, but we're also going to work on armed self-defense. And Huey Newton was in law school at the time. He was taking law classes, so he would read from law books as his group would bring guns, which were legal, you know, in California at the time, and bring them to cases of police brutality and said, you better stop beating on this black man or woman. Because here's the laws that say you're not allowed to do this, and with rifles pointed at the police to stop. And so that's where they got their mentality. Now, in their 10-point plan, that's just one of the other, you know, 9 programs they were working on. The other programs they were working on were free breakfast programs for poor black children. They were working on free health clinics for poor blacks that couldn't afford health care. They were working on political education. They were working on housing organizing and you know, a number of other what they called survival programs. And so they were mostly about political education, free, you know, helping the poor and organizing around that. And also they took a stance against the Vietnam War. But so the militancy of the guns for self-defense and defense of their community from police brutality was just one of their projects of their 10 projects. And the other 9 were, you know, like points, you know, that they worked on were just as important and really, you know, consumed 95% of their activity or 98% of their activity, really. So that's what they really should be known for, is their incredible community organizing and free programs for their poor communities.
There comes a point where during this time, Afeni is arrested and goes to jail. But she goes to jail and she's pregnant. And this is where Tupac is born, correct?
Right. So Tupac's not born in jail, but she was pregnant with him for 8 months while awaiting trial. And so because the New York Panther 21 trial was taking the leaders of all the, you know, the New York branches of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense and putting them on trial. And she was considered one of the 21 top leaders of these thousands of Black Panther Party members. And it was her husband Lumumba Shakur, who were heads of the Harlem Black Panther, you know, chapter. It was also Sekou Odinga was supposed to be part of the Panther 21, but he escaped. He was a close friend of Lumumba Shakur growing up. Saeed Shakur, they didn't put on trial, thankfully, because he was doing great organizing, not being part of the Panther 21 to try to mend the East Coast West Coast rift that, you know, undercover agents and the FBI dirty tactics of false letters and stuff had created. So they were on trial. Some of the Black Panthers of the Panther 21 got lawyers to defend themselves. Afeni Shakur decided to defend herself, and she did incredible work while she was pregnant with Tupac. Now she was it was voted for her to be one of the first released from the Panther 21 from jail to kind of do a speaking tour to raise money for the other Panther 21, you know, that were still in jail waiting trial. And while she was out on bail, she got pregnant with a New Jersey Black Panther. But so her and Lumumba end up divorcing in, you know, while we were still waiting trial, but they still were very close with each other anyway. But Afeni, you know, was amazing in helping the Panther 21 get off in court because of her brilliance and just reading law books and just instantly like teaching herself how to defend herself in court. And then she gave birth to Tupac a month later, right after the trial, after her and the other Panther 21 were acquitted on all charges. Off trumped up charges, you know, framed up charges against them. And so, yeah, Tupac was born into that environment of having the L.A. Black Panther leader, Drama Pratt, as his godfather. Asa Shakur was named as his godmother, and she was a leader, you know, a kind of top organizer in the Bronx Black Panthers, and very close with Zahid Shakur. And so she, you know, changed her name to a Shakur, you know, Asada Shakur, you know, based on her love for him. And so, yeah, that's the way Tupac grew up, in that kind of environment, and became very political at an early age. You know, his mother, Fanny, just called him the Black Prince of the Revolution. And when she says revolution, they usually meant just changing society for the better, not armed overthrow of the government, you know.
Right, yeah.
But, so Tupac, yeah, that's the kind of way he grew up, and the way, you know, she would punish him by making him read the New York Times from cover to cover. So he was, you know, they emphasized reading of loads of great books on, you know, Black history and other just topics. And so Tupac was grew up very well read that way, too.
And it was stressed to him, and you could tell through his music, you could tell through the way he spoke about community, the way he spoke about the way he wanted people to come together, that community was enforced from the time he was little to the time he died, that yeah. he wanted people to come together, that he wanted people to watch after each other. Brenda Had a Baby is a song that is not only heart wrenching, but is really, it gets down to the mindset that he had about a lot of what was going on with, I guess, in his world and in his mindset.
I think I think that's why he's so beloved, is because he was so, you know, he had such a deep emotional lyrics and complex lyrics that way. Complex, you know, like Russell Simmons, the Def Jam production producer, you know, producer of, you know, some of the top first rap bands, said that, like Run DMC and all. He says that Tupac had the most complex, emotionally complex raps, you know, and lyrics and songs of anyone he knew. And so, yeah, Tupac was, you know, that made Tupac beloved by so many, is he's getting so intense emotionally and doing so, you know, writing so much about the community that he wanted to uplift.
Tell you what, we'll take our break right here. When we come back, we're going to talk more with John about Tupac, his life, and where things might have went wrong, and where he was railroaded really by the FBI. We're going to talk about that when we come back. The book is The FBI War on Tupac Shakur, State Repression of Black Leaders from the Civil Rights Era to the 1990s. The website is FBIWarOnTupac.com. Check it out during the break. There's also a link to that in the description of this show. You can check that out in the description of this show. We come back, more with John Potash here on True Crime Tuesday. Welcome back to the Best in True Crime Podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. Our guest is John Potash, and the book is The FBI War on Tupac Shakur, State Repression of Black Leaders from the Civil Rights Era to the 1990s. I'll ask you this right off the bat here, John. What are some of the most interesting facts you found out about Tupac, his music, his activism, and his gangster personality when researching the book? I mean, we think we have an idea of who Tupac is. I think there's a basic public persona we have of Tupac, but what is it that really shocked you about him researching him?
Yeah, so when I saw so much of his activism and so much of his positive activism, it didn't make sense, the gangsta persona. When I was interviewing his longtime mentor, Watani Tayahimba, who was a one-time Los Angeles Black Panther, who was close with Tupac's family for you know, Tupac's, you know, virtually his entire life, he became Tupac's business manager and his political mentor for many years. And I asked Watani, was he only pretending to be a gangster in order to appeal to gangs and politicize them? And Watani said yes, and he explained, yes, he devised that plan with his, you know, imprisoned stepfather Matula Shakur, because what I found out was it was part of the Bloods versus Crips peace truce movement that his Tupac's Black Panther extended family was helping organize and to spread around the country. And so Tupac pretended again to be a gangster in order to appeal to gangs and politicize them and to help them the Bloods and Crips gangs call peace truces and turn on to activism. And that first happened in several major, you know, Los Angeles neighborhoods, and then it spread throughout California, and then spread throughout the country, all within several years of Tupac, you know, being involved in that. And Tupac helped, you know, devise what they called the Thug Life movement and the Code of Thug Life with Matula Shakur, where these gang members promised to cause less damage to their community. You know, if they were going to stay involved in their drug dealing, they would at least make sure that they wouldn't harm their community as much. They wouldn't deal around kids in schools and other things, and they wouldn't hurt, you know, people in their community and, you know, with their violence and their turf wars. But a lot of them actually end up stopping drug dealing and turning on to more positive activities and ways to make money. And he, you know, had, you know, gang leaders shake hands on this at gang peace truce picnics in California. And again, gangs around the country were inspired by this movement, to the point that the largest gang in New York, the Latin Kings, decided to get involved, and they stopped drug dealing and turned on to activism and changed their name to the Almighty Latin King and Queen Nation. And so this was a very powerful movement that he was very successful with his Black Panther extended family and others who were involved. You know, people like Jesse Jackson ended up getting involved, and people like Louis Farrakhan and a lot of others got involved. But it was started by, again, you know, Tupac's Black Panther extended family. And so, but because of that, he became misunderstood, Tupac did. And, you know, because he had this persona that wasn't really him. What he really was before he came out with this idea of the Thug Life movement was a political prodigy, an intellectual prodigy, I mean to say. He, according to Michael Eric Dyson, Professor Michael Eric Dyson, he studied, you know, saw his library in talking to Layla Steinberg, one of Tupac's earlier, kind of mentors in California, who became his first manager. And Tupac had read hundreds of PhD level books before he was out of his teenage years. That's who he was. He rewrote Shakespeare in modern language and directed, produced, and starred in Shakespeare play in California, you know, that way. Mm-hmm. And so he was really just a brilliant, political, emotional, you know, guy who was on a quest to save young Black males, he said. And it's just too bad that he got misunderstood that way by taking on this new persona, you know.
I have a question for you, John, and that is, towards the end of his life, you know, you mentioned the Thug Life creed and trying to bring gangs together. There's a point towards the end of his life where he gets bailed out by Suge Knight, and he signs a contract with Death Row. Well, at this point, you've got Dr. Dre, who bails from Death Row. You've got Snoop, who bails from Death Row. And Suge is very much gang affiliated with the Bloods.
Yeah.
And it's definitely at this point assumed that Tupac has taken a side. Do you feel that kind of derailed Tupac from that vision of uniting gangs? Do you feel that, like, at that point it was looked upon like Tupac had taken a side?
Well, the thing about Tupac is he kept wearing both blue and red at different times. You know, blue bandanas or red bandanas at different times to show that he didn't have an actual affiliation to one, you know, one gang or the other. Mm-hmm. But yes, people might have misperceived him siding too much with obviously Suge Knight, because he couldn't get out of jail any other way. You know, his family and record company had put up about $1.4 million, and I, you know, saw the court documents on this. And it's $1.4 million of a $3 million bail. Now, usually you only need 10% of your bail money to get out of jail.
Right.
But he had, you know, nearly half. And so Suge Knight merely put up $1.5 million versus $1.4 million or something to that effect. And all of a sudden he's let out of jail within several days. Now, this is just one of many, many pieces of evidence that show that Suge Knight and Death Row Records were really a U.S. intelligence front company, believe it or not. Hmm. They had dozens of For example, high-level police detective, Los Angeles police detective Russell Poole, investigated Biggie Smalls. He was the official, one of the two official investigators of Biggie Smalls' murder. And when he investigated Death Row Records, he found that dozens and dozens of his fellow police officers were at all levels of Death Row Records. And he asked his superiors, what are they doing there? And they said, you can call them troubleshooters or covert agents. And so obviously that's, you know, they were running that, they were the real, you know, forces behind Death Row Records. And so the lawyer and the real owner of Death Row Records was Dave Kenner. You know, he was a white lawyer who had basically started Godfather Entertainment, which is the umbrella group company owning Death Row Records. And he had started that with Michael Harry O'Harris. Now, Michael Harry O'Harris was a high-level drug dealer who was one of the two assistants to Freeway Ricky Ross. Freeway Ricky Ross was a national, you know, crack trafficker, you know, crack cocaine trafficker. Mm-hmm. Who got extremely cheap cocaine from his all his CIA assets, who were working with the Nicaraguan Contra Army, which was basically, you know, what Gary Webb, journalist Gary Webb, called a CIA army. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so this was, you know, the connection to U.S. intelligence, the Death Row Records. And, you know, besides just police intelligence officers and Death Row Records, you had the CIA connection there. And so, you know, they were Death Row Records. You know, Russell Poole said he found all the reports and evidence that they were trafficking drugs, they were trafficking guns. And what wasn't emphasized, though, in different reports on Death Row was that they were actually trying to stop the Bloods versus Crips peace truce, trying to end it and try, you know, literally within their own events. They would have undercover agents who were pretending to be Bloods or pretending to be Crips shoot at each other and, you know, end the peace truce that happened, that Tupac had helped engender throughout California, you know, definitely throughout L.A. and then throughout a lot of California. And so, you know, this is what was going on. Now, Tupac was, sadly enough, he went through all kinds of what they called Amnesty International called penal coercion when he was in jail. And Amnesty International said it's the closest thing the U.S. has to brainwashing. Now, I show evidence that there's actually – they have more, you know, with MKUltra, they had more techniques for actual brainwashing, you know, with hypnosis and drugs. But with Tupac, they used all kinds of techniques, torture techniques while Tupac was in jail to mess his head up. They put him in solitary confinement for 10 of his 11 months in jail. And he was in jail only for touching a woman's butt against her will. Okay. Was the official, you know, he was officially found guilty of. This is a woman who agreed they had consensual sex before he touched her butt against her will. Mm-hmm. And he was found not guilty of rape, not guilty of attempted rape, not guilty of sodomy or attempted sodomy or anything else. He was found not guilty on all the other major charges, even gun possession. But is only found guilty of touching her butt against her will. And so for that, he was getting 4.5 years in jail in a maximum security prison, you know, in Dannemora, New York, where they run penal coercion tactics. So his mind was really messed up while he was in jail. He was desperate to get out of the torture, you know, of the anal searches when anyone visited him, despite the fact, you know, they were pretending to search him for contraband, you know, and despite the fact that they were watching all of his prison visits. And so they were torturing him that way in other ways. And the only way he thought he could get out now is to sign to this Death Row agreement that was for a three CD release. And so he signed to the agreement. He produced a double CD for the first two CDs, and then he produced Machiavelli, the 10-Day Theory mm-hmm. album, which was his third CD. He said, I'm done now with my agreement. And he already formed his own record label, Euthanasia Records. He already started his own film group with his activist, assistant, Yasmin Fula, who was the wife of Sekou Odinga, who had started the Bronx Black Panthers with Saeed Shakur. And Afeni Shakur had gotten clean and sober and was working, you know, one is his, as his manager, also helping with some of his PR for his new record company too, and his new film company. And so he was having physical fights with Suge Knight, saying he was done. He was done with Death Row now that he, you know, was finished. He was just close to finishing his third CD. And Suge Knight wouldn't let him out of his of working with Death Row, like, you know, they had signed to. He's saying that, oh no, that Death Row, even though it's a double CD, it's only one CD. So he was really trying to get away from him, but people didn't understand that as well. And so Tupac was hated what Death Row was doing. Death Row was running the penal coercion outside of prison. They were using all the same tactics that was used against Tupac in prison, but when Tupac outside of prison, in terms of like shooting people right in front of Tupac to warn him, you know, beating people right in front of him to warn him, you better not, you know, this is what happens to people who turn on Death Row Records. And so they were really messing his head up, and they were giving him constant weed and alcohol. When he got out of prison, said, okay, let's get right into the studio and produce these, you know, this album. So that's when he produced, you know, some of the most negative lyrics he's ever produced was drunk and stoned right out of prison with his head still messed up. And then when he started getting away from that, you know, all that influence, all that negative influence of Death Row, got engaged to Kadada Jones, Quincy Jones's daughter, and was planning to have a baby with her and move into their own apartment because they were originally a Death Row owned apartment. And he got away from drinking and drugging. He witnesses at parties said everybody's drinking and smoking weed at the party, and Tupac was the only one that didn't touch any alcohol or weed and was just dancing for hours on end. And so this is, how he was changing at the end of his life, and sad that we couldn't see that full change away from Death Row Records and their negative influence.
Towards the end of his life, on your research, are you finding that it was more Suge feeling the East Coast, West Coast feud more so than Tupac? Because Tupac was quite vocal, about the whole Death Row versus Bad Boy thing.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, they first used the same tactics they used against Tupac's Black Panther mother, Harlem Black Panther leader Fannie Shakur, when she was in jail against the West Coast Oakland Black Panthers like Huey Newton. They sent fake letters, and this is documented in COINTELPRO Papers, a book that shows the actual FBI counterintelligence program documents that were, showed their tactics that they used to form, you know, get the New York Black Panthers fighting with the Oakland Black Panthers, sending fake letters back and forth and using undercover agents. And FBI COINTELPRO agent M. Wesley Swearingen came out with a book in 1995 called is a memoir that said that he knew that he talked to his fellow agents and, you know, the FBI, and he was in the FBI when it was, you know, when the counterintelligence program, that official program that was found out about because activists raided an FBI office and took all the documents and sent them out to the press that showed the counterintelligence program they were using. It was a program started to target leftist activists in general, but particularly brutally target Black leftists, such as the Black Panthers. And so in those documents, you know, we found out about the counterintelligence program. So because they raided that office and exposed it in 1971, the FBI said we were closing down the program, you know, under pressure from politicians. But then they actually kept it open and under different names, according to Wes Swearingen in his memoir. And they kept it open at least until 1995 when he came out with his book, Swearingen. And so so obviously they were likely using that against Black Panther national leader, Tupac Shakur, because Tupac was head of a group called the New African Panthers when he was 18 years old. And that group was active in 8 to 10 cities. So Tupac was already a national Black leader, you know, activist leader before he became a rapper. And so that's why, of course, they would target Tupac, and with their, you know, counterintelligence program still going on under different names. And so, yes, you know, that's some of the evidence that they did target Tupac that way. And you said, you know, with Suge Knight, he was like low man on the totem pole of U.S. intelligence. He was just similar to the guy, if you saw the undercover agent in Judas and the Black Messiah that targeted Fred Hampton. He had increasing crimes that were, you know, he was supposed to get increasing jail time for, and all of a sudden he got let off of a more, you know, intense violent crime. Mm-hmm. And obviously he was asked to do undercover work, but he was low man on the totem pole, with Dave Kenner being much higher on the totem pole, and the police intelligence in Death Row Records being, you know, really more powerful in terms of what they were doing, especially the leader of the police security in Death Row Records, Reggie Wright Jr., because Reggie Wright Sr. was head of the Compton gang police unit, and where it was, which was one of the first places that the gang peace truces happened. And the turn, you know, the change to activism happened amongst the Bloods and the Crips in the Compton neighborhood. So that's why they were, you know, that was why they were targeting Tupac with their own family members, you know, police intelligence. And they got this police officer, Reggie Wright Jr., to pretend to retire from police and head Death Row Security, but he was actually still working undercover, all the best evidence shows. And that's the way it worked.
As far as Suge today and having to serve the jail sentence, what went wrong there? Is it just simply that too much time has gone by? Death Row is dismantled and that immunity is worn off?
Well, what I show is that, okay, Death Row Records police were drug, you know, these people were drug trafficking, gun running. They were trying to end the Bloods versus Crips peace truce. When Tupac was on his deathbed for 7 days, they sent loads of guns to the Crips and said, you know, everyone knows that, I mean, to the Bloods, and said, everyone knows that the Crips killed Tupac and, you know, it's time to get revenge. And so for 7 days, all of a sudden the Bloods versus Crips peace truce ended, and people were shot and killed because people were so upset about Tupac getting shot. And then Tupac died. But right after Tupac died, activists spread the word that no, it wasn't the Crips that killed Tupac. It was someone else. It was other forces. And, you know, they stopped the Bloods versus Crips, you know, warring again, and got the peace truce going again. And So this is, yeah. So I think that the top motive, you know, one of the top parts of their agenda with Suge Knight was to kill Tupac Shakur. And so once they accomplished that, he was not needed anymore. And that's when he lost his legal immunity to crimes. He was committing crimes the entire time he was leading Death Row Records, but they just never would arrest him for anything. He was committing crimes in public and getting Dr. Dre arrested, but he wouldn't get arrested. That's the way it always happened. And so, yeah. And so it seemed to work. And so, but after they killed Tupac, he lost his legal immunity, and they said, okay, we're done with him. And because that's why, you know, he was a low man on the totem pole. So, yeah.
The night that Tupac died in Las Vegas, there was that skirmish in the lobby of the hotel. Walk me through it for a second here, John, because it you know, they're coming from the Tyson fight. And to me, it seems a little forced, but it seems like something that could have happened. Walk me through that. In your research, does it seem like this is completely contrived, or is it something that just naturally happened?
So British filmmaker Nick Broomfield, who produced the film Biggie and Tupac, and then produced an update of that film just within the last year or two, came out with an update of that film. He said that when he did more investigation on Orlando Anderson, he said Orlando Anderson could be called the Lee Harvey Oswald of Tupac's assassination. He says he was a patsy. He was given tons of money to take a beating in that MGM Grand, you know, hotel lobby. And the reason what they did is they used all kinds of psychological operations. Basically, they knew Tupac had a chain ripped off his neck by a certain member of a gang at one point, maybe 2 years before. Mm-hmm. And so guys in Death Row, you know, who were talking to Tupac throughout that, first thing is Tupac broke his vow for sobriety and ended up going to a party before the fight and getting drunk and stoned. But meanwhile, before that, he had driven to that to Las Vegas with Kadada Jones in a bulletproof vest. He was so scared. And he wasn't even supposed to go to Las Vegas that night. He was planning one of his two top bodyguards, Kevin Hackey, was also getting paid by the FBI. And Kevin Hackey turned on the FBI show and convinced Tupac not to go to Vegas that night, but to go to Atlanta with his family. And Tupac was going to do that, but he had a court hearing on a guy in his car that was caught with weed, and he got a possession charge on it, and he was forced to do a benefit concert that night by the judge, which was unusual, but he was happy to not get put back in jail, but just be forced to do a benefit concert. But it was that night of the Mike Tyson fight, so he decided, even though Kevin Hackey had convinced him not to go to Vegas, he just better go to Vegas and do that benefit concert afterwards. And he did. He was friends with Mike Tyson. They did want to see him, but he was scared to death of going to Vegas. So he wore a bulletproof vest while going through, driving to Las Vegas to play the heat. He eventually got too hot and took off the bulletproof vest. And so he's in the, he's at Vegas. He's going to the party. He told Kadeda not to join him because, he was scared for her life, too, along with his own life. But he ended up getting drunk and stoned, and he was more easily manipulated into getting mad at someone who, when this guy says to him, "Oh, that guy over there, Orlando Anderson, he tore a chain off my neck, death row chain off my neck, and beat me up or did something negative like that." So Tupac was convinced to join this guy in confronting Orlando Anderson. And, punches were thrown, and then it was all over in 5 to 10 seconds. But and Orlando Anderson didn't even report anything after that. And Nick Broomfield said it was obvious that Orlando Anderson was paid to be a patsy, to take the beating, to make it look like the Crips killed Tupac. But the best evidence was, according to Russell Poole, was that Russell Poole said, "My fellow officers, in Death Row Records, police officers set up Tupac's murder, and then they killed Biggie to make it look like an East Coast West Coast rivalry that killed Tupac, and to hide their own murder of Tupac."
Man, I know it was a devastating time, especially if you're a fan of both or either one. I don't think you could have been a fan of one or not the other. I mean, just as a fan of that genre,
of course, yeah. Friends, and Biggie and Tupac were friends. Until all these undercover agents set him up to be rivals. But even in the very end, Tupac said, "I'm gonna start albums called One Nation to bring East Coast and West Coast rappers together, just to fight for good causes and community centers around the country, and to do good work together."
Even at the Source Awards, when you had Suge standing up there saying, if you want to be a rapper that doesn't have the producer up dancing and singing in your records, and tried to take a shot at Bad Boy, and Bad Boy was taking shots at Death Row. And even though it felt kind of icky between the two, I think there was still kind of hope that that would die down. And eventually it did. I mean, eventually you had Snoop working with East Coast rappers, and everything did come back together. But unfortunately, it took the deaths of two really great talents for that to come back together.
Right. And it was sad because, it wasn't coming from Puffy and Biggie. It was coming from Suge Knight and Death Row Records people. And, I think they were all, doing the bidding of police intelligence, U.S. intelligence, to create this kind of, violent rivalry atmosphere, just to hide what they were really doing, which was trying to kill, activists such as Tupac or anyone else who were turning on to activism, such as, Puffy was actually got involved in Russell Simmons' group, which was an activist group that I talk about in my book a bit, that actually had a 10-point program that tried to replicate the activism of the Black Panthers, but through, not through a Black Panther party, but through rappers and activists coming together. There was, various Manning Marable, professor at Columbia University, was part of the group, and they targeted other rappers such as Puffy and other people. Even though Puffy wasn't such an activist, he did become an activist in that way. But they targeted him. They targeted Russell Simmons. They targeted, Shirley Evans. So they targeted a number of members of the top members of that group to stop what they were doing. In trying to bring the East Coast and West Coast together in solid activism, which Tupac wanted at the very end of his life, in talking about, we want to bring West Coast and East Coast together under this One Nation album, and now my W hand sign only stands for war against those who oppose freedom for Black America, and not it doesn't stand for West Coast anymore, he said. And he was changing, and it's so sad that he couldn't accomplish everything he would have accomplished, you know, before he died.
If you'll engage me with this for a second, John, I want to throw this out there, and it's a bit of conspiracy theory, but after Tupac dies, of course, you've got people saying, well, Tupac didn't, of course, die. He was trying to get away from death row. He faked his own death, so to speak. There were autopsy photos that came out saying this couldn't have been Tupac. The tattoos are on the wrong side. How much credence do you lend to those theories, and how realistic could those theories really be?
I think those theories are just our wishes and hopes, and they're well-meaning hope that Tupac didn't die. You know, Chuck D was a leader of one of those theories, and Chuck D really was close with Tupac and didn't want him to die. They were both close, and it's just I don't blame him. And, you know, so there's a lot of things to try to reach for, to try to hope that he's still alive. And of course, I wish he was still alive too. But all the best evidence is that he did die, sadly enough, and that the closest mentors I talked to in terms of, you know, Watani Taiyahimba, Fannie Shakur, and his New York trial lawyer, Michael Warren, and his Atlanta trial lawyer, and his national lawyer, Chukwi Lumumba, they all, you know, said, of course, he did die, but, you know, his legacy lives on, and his inspiration lives on in many others.
As we tape this, we're taping this on Monday. It's less than 12 hours from the Super Bowl halftime show, which has got to rank within the top three, I would think, of Super Bowl halftime shows. That's just me being subjective. Of all time, I thought it was amazing, me being a fan of that genre. I was blown away by what was done. You see the legacy of that tree that's there of Dr. Dre, of everything that he's brought along up until current day with Kendrick Lamar, all the way to the beginnings with NWA. And I think that the biggest part of that was missing, of course, was Tupac. And I just want to get your thoughts about it real quick.
Yeah, and so I think that so they paid tribute to Tupac by doing 45 seconds of California Love, the Tupac song with Dre singing in Tupac's place. But Dre had produced that song with Snoop Dogg and Tupac. And, you know, and they also did Dre did the piano for I Ain't Mad At You, the piano opening for Tupac's song, while Eminem took a knee and bowed his head as a tribute to Tupac. And so, you know, fans of Tupac recognize that the piano intro to that song, I Ain't Mad At You, and mm-hmm. they played, I believe that was the song, the piano intro for that one. But it was just nice that they paid tribute in different ways. Now, someone said they also paid tribute by showing the back of what looked like Tupac looking over Los Angeles. I didn't catch that part of it, of the end of the halftime show, but nonetheless, it was great that they did that, and I thought that it was a really nice performance by Snoop Dogg and Dre. And actually, someone else said what's interesting is that the set showed at one point a sign of the area where Dr. Dre was had killed somebody with his car and was put in jail for years. And so that was like a saying, hey, we know you're involved and we're glad you're in jail, believe it or not, because they're so mad. They're so upset with Suge Knight's behavior. He basically, you know, Dre was the creative force behind Death Row and he left with nothing. Snoop Dogg was literally chased by Suge Knight's thugs and, almost beaten and had to run to actually police to not get killed by Suge Knight's thugs and ran from Death Row Records. And here they are showing, you know, we hate you for being involved in Tupac's murder.
Yeah.
It's interesting that, but they, you know, Snoop Dogg just bought Death Row Records. So we are going to continue the legacy of the great music without the police involvement and, you know, the undercover, you know, police involvement in Death Row Records.
Right on. So, John, let me ask you this. What do you hope to accomplish by bringing all this research to light through this book? And again, the book is The FBI War on Tupac Shakur, State Repression of Black Leaders from the Civil Rights Era to the 1990s.
Well, I hope to get it to stop, to get them to stop targeting great activist rappers. I hope to get them to stop their horrible oppression of great activists, great black activists, and activists in general. But, sadly enough, it's continued. And I showed some of the ways it continued after Tupac of targeting activist rappers. But you're just seeing activist rappers in, just in my Baltimore area, maybe 3 to 6 activist rappers have been killed. You know, I saw in the Baltimore Sun just in the past, 5 or 10 years. It's really sad how this is happening. It continues. And I was hoping to shed a light on it, to stop it, and to just, educate people on the great underground black activism that's been happening with through the Shakurs and others for many, many years. And hopefully we can get Mumia out of jail and Matulu out of jail. You know, Matulu, as I said, was a great acupuncturist who started Lincoln Detox in the Bronx using acupuncture against drug addiction. And that was Tupac's stepfather. And hopefully we can free them and see black activism flourish again, and without police brutality and oppression.
And give us a little bit of a, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And just without U.S. intelligence oppression,
Right.
Oppression.
And give us a little bit of a taste of the worldwide exhibition of Tupac life and legacy and what we expect to see and where you're going to bring it. Because I know right now it's in Los Angeles, correct?
So it's not, I'm not involved in that.
Oh, you're not? Okay.
Yeah, but it's the Tupac family estate is very involved in that. And so that's your first showing in Los Angeles for 6 months. It's a museum that they created there, and with all Tupac stuff and all Fannie Shakur's memorabilia and about the Panther legacy, but also about Tupac's life, of course, and times, and it's called Wake Me When I'm Free. And so it's going to start with 6 months exhibition in Los Angeles, and then it's going to move. It's going to travel to other cities around the country to educate people on Tupac's activism and his family's great activism.
Okay. Well, again, the name of the book is The FBI War on Tupac Shakur, State Repression of Black Leaders from the Civil Rights Era to the 1990s. You can check it out at FBIWarOnTupac.com. We got a link for that right here in the description of this program. I encourage you to go check it out. Go pick up the book. Lots of stuff that we didn't even cover in this program in that book, and you're going to want to check it out for yourself. John Potash, I appreciate you joining us today. Quite timely, not just with Black History Month, but especially with the Super Bowl last night.
And thanks just for having me on, Tim.
Yeah, thank you, John. Just reminding us how much we really do miss Tupac in this day and age. All right, it's a time where if you're listening to the free version of the show, we must bid you adieu. But if you don't want to leave us right now, you don't necessarily have to. What you can do is you can go to Stitcher.com, click on the subscribe button under Stitcher Premium. That will get you to listen to Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals. That'll get you to listen to the ad-free version of Darkness Radio. And that'll get you to listen to hundreds of podcasts ad-free and expand your audio horizons more than you could possibly ever imagine. And the best thing is you can do it for just $5 a month. Do it right now. Go to Stitcher.com, click on that premium button, subscribe to Stitcher Premium for just $5 a month. You'll get Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals as far as True Crime Tuesday. You'll get an ad-free Darkness Radio. And of course, you'll get hundreds of podcasts ad-free and expand those audio horizons. Go ahead and do it today.